On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Theme of the week, more war. In Lebanon, where the destruction is profound and Israeli forces are up against a tenacious foe, now widely celebrated in the Arab world. In Israel, where Hezbollah rockets continue to rain. In Rome and beyond, where Condoleezza Rice says no ceasefire until. In Baghdad, where civilian dead numbers dwarf Lebanon's 600, and even President Bush concedes the situation is terrible. Joining me now in the studio is David Gergen. He served as presidential advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's now director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, editor-at-large for U.S. News & World Report. He's author of Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, from Nixon to Clinton. David Gergen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you both.
And with us from Washington, Eleanor Clift, contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. Her column, Capital Letter, is posted every Friday at Newsweek.com and MSNBC. She was in Israel on the Lebanese border just the week before the violence broke out. Eleanor is a political analyst for Fox News and a panelist on the PBS show, The McLaughlin Group. Eleanor, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
I guess there's no question about the top story this week. I'm eager to hear what each of you think about the fighting in the Middle East, Lebanon, Israel, and the U.S. position on it. David Gergen, first to you. What's your big view on what's going on here?
I can't remember a time in the last 30 years when an American White House has faced as many raging wildfires in the Middle of the East as we do today. And the real danger, of course, is that they'll come together and cause a real conflagration. I think the one thing it's pretty clear now here at the end of some 15, 16 days of fighting is that the repercussions of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah are really spreading now across the Arab world, very much complicating our situation in Iraq, and I think causing even bigger diplomatic headaches for the United States.
Eleanor Clift, David Gergen says he can't remember when there was such a risk of conflagration, of crises merging in the Middle East, and conflagration. Is George Bush, in effect, saying, bring it on? He's saying we need clarity here about what's going on. Is this another bring it on moment for the president?
Well, this president has a tendency, when there's a problem, to put it in a larger context. I mean, he is almost contemptuous of an immediate ceasefire, saying that that wouldn't solve the long-range problem. He thinks of himself as this bold, visionary leader, and that anything is better than the status quo, and he wants to just reshuffle the deck and shape a new Middle East. But we're learning there are lots of things can be worse than the status quo. And I think some of the talk last week about the opportunity that this presented to bring clarity, and you heard Israeli officials also using the word opportunity to deal with Hezbollah once and for all, which I think is another illusion. But I think people are a little more sober this week because Hezbollah is putting up a pretty stiff resistance, and taking on an insurgency of any kind is difficult for a superpower. And in the Middle East, Israel is a superpower.
A superpower, but in some very tough fighting this week. This is no cakewalk, yet avowedly very determined. Let's listen to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert saying there will be no let-up against Hezbollah.
We will not hesitate to take the most severe measures against those who are aiming thousands of rockets and missiles against innocent civilians for one purpose, to kill them.
There it is. We will not let up. David Gergen, do people have choices here? I mean, President Bush is saying he's making a choice. He's making a choice not to go for what Condoleezza Rice calls an easy ceasefire that just covers up old problems. Choices are being made. Are they pushing us closer to that conflagration you're talking about deliberately? Or do they somehow pull us away from trouble?
Well, let's start with the proposition that Israel was attacked here. They were the victim, and they were attacked by a vicious terrorist organization, Hezbollah, and it's understandable they would respond and respond fiercely. What becomes a question is whether it's now in Israel's best interest. It's also a question of whether it's in America's best interest for this to continue much longer. What the administration has done, the Bush administration has done, is to really break with the past. this is a sharp break with the tradition of how American governments deal with violence in the Middle East. Traditionally, the U.S. has been on the side of immediate ceasefires. Let's try to get peace. Let's try to establish some sort of status quo, as Eleanor suggested, and then let's figure out how we go from there.
Warren Quist, Christopher, former Secretary of State, writing today, it's time to act. It's time to get that ceasefire. There's the old impulse that you described.
Well, it's the old impulse. It's we've seen it from Henry Kissinger to Warren Christopher. This is cross-party lines. It is the view that you try to make people stop fighting first, and then you see if you can't settle their differences. You patch things together. You try to, and you do live a little bit from crisis to crisis. but at least there's been a containment of the violence, we haven't driven differing Arab parties together. In this case, we now see at the end of this week the Shias and becoming allies of the Sunnis, for goodness sakes, and that the Egyptian government and the Saudi government, which was in our corner as this fight started, are now moving the other way because of what's happening among the Arab populations. The Arab populations are rallying to the side of Hezbollah.
A couple of weeks ago, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Egyptian governments speaking out against Hezbollah, now basically afraid to do that. Their own people, even because Sunni populations, saying, go Shia.
Go Shia, and we're making a hero of this of the leader of the Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it's going to make it much more complicated to try to settle this when it's over. The other sharp departure, I happen to be a friend of Israel. I'm a great supporter of Israel, but I think it's possible for the United States to have more than one friend in the Middle East at the same time. We should be able to be friends with Israel and still be friends with Jordan, for example, and many others. And in the past, it has been a primary view of the United States that we should be the honest broker in the Middle East, that we should be the party that's on the side and is a friend of Israel, but we also help to strike honest deals and to be a mediator. And this time, we have so sharply broken from that old tradition of being an honest broker that I worry a lot that it is not in America's best interest and it's not in Israel's best interest for the United States to abandon that role and not play a significant part. We will not be a big partner in the same way we've been in the past in figuring out what's a just solution when this is over. This is going to end in diplomacy, after all.
And the question is, what kind of role the U.S., what kind of strength it will bring to that
Absolutely.
Diplomatic arena?
Whether we have the moral stature to be a mediator, and I think that we're going to find ourselves increasingly finding others are going to be asked by the Arab nations, who they trust them more, to step in, and that's not in Israel's best interest.
New York Times, Tom Friedman writing today, the world hates George Bush more than any U.S. president in my lifetime. He is radioactive, saying we don't have that moral stature. President Bush putting it in big terms, though, that we've got to stand up for what's right here. Let's listen. Here he is, speaking to reporters, rejecting calls for a quick ceasefire. He says his goal is a lasting peace.
Hopefully end this as quickly as possible, and at the same time making sure there's a lasting peace. Not a fake peace, not a fake, kind of circumstances that make us all feel better, and then sure enough the problem arises again.
Eleanor Clift, we saw the photos of Condoleezza Rice in Rome. Maybe it was just a moment, but she was looking, put upon there, looking weary there, carrying this message. Is White House resolve standing up firmly here, or is the pushback from abroad raising any cracks of doubt?
Well, I think she did look dismayed there, but I don't see any weakening on her part in this insistence that they have to go for a broader peace. I mean, fake pieces at least stop people from getting killed while you're talking. And diplomacy, as somebody once compared it to riding a stationary bike, you have to just keep the motion going. And this administration seems to want to do everything differently from its predecessors. And there are some problems that you can't solve, that you just manage. And the administration, by its posture that will only talk to people, to leaders who they agree with, has basically left Iran and Syria out of the picture in terms of trying to forge some sort of compromise peace here. And yet the administration is accusing those countries of being behind what's happening in the Middle East. So, the words sound nice and tough, but what's missing here, all the back channels and the diplomacy that basically kept the lid on in this very volatile part of the world. And there's an ignorance of history, which I think led us to go into Iraq and thinking that we could stitch together a democracy in this country that was really three very different ethnic groups, and sectarian violence has torn apart Lebanon for a very long time. They just emerged from their civil war in 1991, and the government there is quite fragile.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a week of war in the Middle East and battles at home, on abortion, on John Bolton, on presidential power. My guest, David Gergen, advisor to four presidents in the White House, and joining us from Washington, Eleanor Clift, contributing editor at Newsweek magazine, back just a couple of weeks ago from that very Israel-Lebanon border. The Iraqi prime minister in town last week, al-Maliki, talking with Congress through an interpreter, saying Iraq stands with the U.S. against terrorism.
History will prove that the sacrifices of Iraqis for freedom will not be in vain. Iraqis are your allies in the war on terror.
Iraqis will stand with the U.S. in the war on terror. Senator Jack Reed, Democrat, Rhode Island, said the speech was too optimistic.
In some cases, I think the prime minister was speaking in the style more of the president of the Baghdad Chamber of Commerce than the prime minister of Iraq, in a very difficult situation that is close to a overt, explicit civil war.
President of the Baghdad Chamber of Commerce, David Gergen, what's your sense? How much further can the U.S. go down this road? I mean, there does not seem to be—I don't know what Tony Blair exactly will come away from Washington with, but there doesn't seem to be much consensus around Washington's view that let the fighting go on. There's a big cry for a ceasefire out there. Iraq, very, very few folks in Washington's corner at this point. But yet the president, with a similar kind of line, as Eleanor said, that we went into Iraq with, this is the right thing, we're going to do it. How long can we go down this road?
I don't think anybody knows. Eleanor is right. We see no signs of the administration backing away from its hardline view. The Israelis have voted to at least contain the fighting, but they have also voted to call up more reserves as a signal that they are prepared to go on if necessary. My bet is that the international pressure is going to grow to such an extent that within a few days now, the United States will begin putting pressure on Israel to start closing us down, especially, Tom, if it appears that indeed the fighting is only building Hezbollah up in the minds of people in Lebanon and the Arab world, as opposed to diminishing their strength. After all, we are taking out some of their rockets now, but there are going to be more rockets in the future. And if more people sign up with Hezbollah in the future, that only weakens Israel. So there comes to be a point at which you say, is this really in Israel's best interest to continue this? Is this usually really in the United States' best interest to continue this? And I think a growing number of people, Warren Christopher is an example, I think a growing number of people now are going to say, it's time. It's time to really start shutting this down. That's what we all expected, by the way, a week ago. We thought maybe this would go on 2 weeks. It's now beyond the two-week point. Mm-hmm. I would imagine now is going to be almost overwhelming pressure which the administration will gradually yield to over the next 5 to 10 days.
Maybe. Eleanor, you were in Israel recently, and you came back looking back on that time and saying maybe not. Maybe this is just the first phase, that many Israelis think that the battle against Hezbollah is just the beginning of a bigger Israeli push against its enemies.
Right. I was there when the conflict with Hamas in Gaza was heating up. And I know when I told people I was going to Israel, they thought, gee, it's not safe. And I must say, I never felt for a moment threatened. Gaza could have been as far away as Iraq if you were in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem.
But now Israelis are in bomb shelters.
Right, exactly. And we were taken on a tour of the borders, and we stood looking across at Lebanon and looking through binoculars and seeing the Hezbollah fighters and seeing the UN encampment right nearby. And the officials were telling us that their goal with Gaza was to neutralize the border to the point where they had with Lebanon, where it seemed to be relatively peaceful. Now, maybe we weren't getting information from the very top, but it seemed to me the Israelis really did not expect the Hezbollah to wage this kind of assault on them.
They weren't surprised by the kidnapping, you point out. There have been many efforts to take Israeli soldiers.
There were many efforts, exactly. But once it was successful, I think the determination was that they were going to respond with such force that Hezbollah wouldn't dare do it again, which is the same kind of thinking that the U.S. had, with shock and awe in Iraq.
But
that
first
would have
phase onto Syria, onto Iran, onto Iran's nuclear weapon?
many of the officials we talked to talked about Syria behind it, Iran behind it, and the fear that the U.S. wouldn't act, that NATO was incapable of acting, and that in the end that Israel was going to have to, you know, do something to take on its real enemies in the region. And the way this is being framed is it's all one fight. It's
framed by whom,
it's,
Eleanor?
It's framed by the leaders of this country and mm-hmm. of Israel mm-hmm. that this is a fight against terrorism and Islamic extremism, and it's all one fight, that it's that you put Iraq into it and you put what's happening in the Middle East. And you know, I would argue that Iraq was a whole separate thing that had nothing really to do with the war on terror. It now has become a breeding ground, I think, for Islamic extremists, but that's a result of our actions there. And the administration now is talking about putting more troops into Baghdad. I mean, not enlarging the overall number, but to beefing up the U.S. presence in Baghdad.
Where
and
the big security
in Iraq
plan,
are,
yeah. It was, yeah, it was supposed to
mounting.
Be getting better there. You know.
This is the very danger, though, that these wildfires will come together. I mean, if they don't come together physically as a war, they may well come together psychologically in the minds of the Islamic peoples. And if they see this gradually, increasingly, a war by America and Israel against Islam, that's extraordinarily destabilizing for the Middle East. It does mean years and years of conflict and struggle that is not in America's best interest.
Isn't that the way Osama bin Laden wanted to frame
exactly
this?
Right.
I mean, isn't that the path to Armageddon?
If you inflame people, you know, one of the reasons that people have said we should not get into any kind of conflict with Iran is that it drives the Iranians together. It's a society with many different kinds of belief systems now, but you can drive people together all as nationalists. And if you drive people together, which is what's happening now, and we talk about the Arab Street somewhat loosely, but you can see the change. It's being played up not only in the New York Times, it's being played up in the European newspapers today, mm-hmm. The Financial Times and others, that there is a change in the psychology that's happening in the Arab world, so that even if Israel temporarily, and if we went temporarily win some, you know, we take out some batteries, we take out some, take out some people in Hezbollah, we can lose the war for the hearts and minds of people. And that, in the long term, is really critical to the overall stability of the Middle East.
Let me begin to turn to our callers. David Gergen, Eleanor Clift, please stand by. TJ's calling from Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, TJ, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and great panel, great show, great admirer. Quick question to your panel. My question is, I'm a fairly newly naturalized American citizen, so the politics is not very clear to me. But from what I read and from what I hear, I noticed that our foreign policy is not really balanced, and it doesn't target the core issues on these conflicts that our nation gets involved in. Right now we're talking about the war in the Middle East, but if we really got down to the question of why are they fighting and how can we solve it, would be, I think, more practical to your listeners and to the public. There's a tendency of trying to put out fires after they're already ignited. Usually that gets us in trouble as big as we are.
But the Bush administration says pretty plainly, we want a new way in the Middle East. We want a democratic Middle East. We don't want to put up with all this old malarkey, and we want to defend a democratic ally in Israel. Pretty simple.
My reply to that would be, the Middle East has existed longer than us. I think we've been around for 300 years. They've been around close to 4,000 or 5,000 years. So for us to tell them how the new way is, our way or no way, has a tendency of not being diplomatic. I say this because I've seen other systems, being a new American here.
TJ, I think we've got it, and we'll put that to our panel. Let me get another call or two first. Aaron's calling from Boston. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good. What do you think, Aaron?
I guess what I'm worried about is this kind of narrative that's going on both sides, and especially the use of terms like proportionality.
The criticism heavy from Europe that Israel's response has been disproportionate.
Yeah, and especially from someone like Putin. I don't really see much proportion with Chechnya, and mm-hmm. I just see, you know, Israel kind of surrounded on all sides by people that, even if they're at peace technically with Jordan and Egypt, I think people in Israel are always existential crisis.
So you think they've got to do what they've got to do, Aaron? What about David Gergen's fear that we sort of galvanize a united, angry Middle East against Israeli and American interests.
Well, I think that's a valid point, but I heard Imad Mustafa, the ambassador from Syria to the U.S. Mm-hmm. a couple weeks ago, you know, if it's not the Shabaab farms, it's the Golan. If it's not the Golan, it's prisoners. If it's not that, it's the West Bank. I mean, I think that there's always going to be something that they're going to come back with, regardless of what Israel does.
Aaron, we've got it. And let me get one more. Mike from Altoona, Pennsylvania. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Mike, I'm just a basic truck, simple truck driver, so, and I get my news from NPR.
Like all truck drivers.
Yeah. So what do you think, Mike?
But my problem is why we're not using more intelligence and ground troops. Now, Israel is just bombing and bombing over and over. They're blowing up ambulances. They're blowing up UN people. Why aren't we using more ground forces and intelligence to fight a war as opposed just to bombing everybody and killing all these innocent civilians?
Well, I mean, Hezbollah is woven in there pretty deep, but let us pick that up, Mike, and thanks for your call. David Gergen, you know, the destruction looks bad. Mm-hmm. And we don't see the half of it on American television compared to what the rest of the world is looking at.
Well, the rest of the world is looking at satellite pictures, which are mostly coming from Lebanon. And they show, children being maimed and adults fleeing and this great flood of refugees. And so the rest of the world, especially in the Arab world, is becoming very sympathetic to those who are being hit and not to the Israelis who were originally hit.
It was the Israelis who were violated to start with. But Hezbollah is woven deep into the fabric of these communities.
It is. And, that's the notion that I was really surprised to see an op-ed piece by Senator Joe Biden saying, well, what we have to do is just get some international forces in and disarm Hezbollah. As if, that's going to be an easy thing to do. Hezbollah not only has a military arm, it has a social arm in Lebanon, and they have been extremely helpful to the poor people of Lebanon with meeting their daily needs. And so it's a very popular group in much of Lebanon, and that's why they got some seats in parliament, even though they have a terrorist arm. So to disarm Hezbollah is like asking the Lebanese government or asking the UN to disarm Hezbollah right now is asking them, in effect, to do what Israel is to do Israel's work, to do Israel's bidding, and that's going to be impossible for a Lebanese government to do. That's asking too much, and that's why I'm afraid we're going to. There is no perfect world, and just as we're now disillusioned about what we're creating in Iraq and realize it's not going to be the democracy, the shiny democracy we thought it might be, I think we're going to have to face up to the reality that the Middle East is going to continue to be an extraordinarily dangerous place, and what is best for the parties is to come to some sort of uneasy peace that leaves them not living in complete security. But it's been Israel has had a much, much better time of it in the last 15, 20 years since Camp David, since we patched together these things, than it used to have before that when wars broke out frequently. So has the peace been perfect since the mid-1970s? No. And since Kissinger and Carter and all these other people got into the middle of this? No, it's not been perfect. But it's been one heck of a lot better than what they had before that.
Let's take a call from Providence, Rhode Island. Marie's on the line. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'll try to be quick on this. I was looking through some old papers, and I came across Providence Journal Bulletin, Monday, December 26, 1988.
Okay, you're time traveling. Back in history, what do you see?
Okay, on the front page is Barbara Bush and Father Bush talking, singing at the Baptist Church.
Okay.
Next to it says Mubarak. Says he's willing to go to Israel.
Yep.
Egyptian president may be signaling.
So problems in the Middle East. What else have you got there?
Okay. Then on the editorial page, it shows a picture of it's a cartoon, and it says, "Oh dear, I know what's." It says the Iron Triangle. A picture. It's a triangle, and it says deficit, deficit, deficit. Scrunched up, Father Bush's face.
So we've got Bush, we've got deficits, we've got trouble in the Middle East. Marie, we've got the picture. It seems like things don't change. Eleanor Clift, in Washington now, with the position that President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have taken, how do you read their support in Washington, in the GOP and beyond? Do they have backing beyond the White House?
They have enormous backing in Washington. The Republicans are certainly behind the administration when it comes to Israel. When the Prime Minister from Iraq spoke in the Congress, you had some Democrats boycotting the speech because he had been critical of Israel's actions in the Middle East. And so I think, you know, politically, there is enormous sympathy with Israel, and everybody understands that Israel needs to defend itself. But problem is that the iron fist doesn't work. It just creates a new generation of the same problem. And, you know, David Gergen was in the White House when President Reagan was there, and U.S. troops were in Lebanon, and you had similar situation to what we have today. And we had the killing of the Marines, 240-odd Marines, and President Reagan got out of Lebanon, and Lebanon went on to have great difficulty, and Israel occupied it for a long time. But the U.S. finally got out. And I think the polls show that the American people do not believe that there will be peace in the Middle East in anybody's lifetime, and they do not want heavy U.S. involvement, especially military involvement, despite the sympathy that this country has and identification, really, with Israel.
David Gergen, how do you read those polls? Some new ones out this week. Eleanor says Washington's solid behind the president here. What about the American people?
The American people, well, a New York Times CBS poll found that some 45% of the people support what the president has done here with regard to Israel and Hezbollah. They like his stance. Yeah, a little higher, a plurality in favor of the president. But it also showed a rising isolationist streak to support Eleanor's point that Americans are sympathetic with Israel, but they do not want to put American troops in Lebanon. They do not want to do what President Reagan
did. And at this point,
no
one's proposing that.
No, we're not. But Americans basically want to let the parties settle this on their own. They don't want to get more deeply involved. And I think there's going to be political pressure to step up the timetable in Iraq as a result of this. Generally, Americans find this, as all of it, I mean, I think everybody finds this extremely confusing.
We're talking this hour about a week of war in the Middle East and battles at home on abortion, on John Bolton, on presidential power. David Gergen is with us. He's advisor to four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. Eleanor Cliff joins us from Washington. She's contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. John Bolton, the president got him in with a recess appointment. It's coming up for renewal. A lot of talk about that in Washington this week. Here's Richard Lugar, Republican, Indiana, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, saying the scrutiny of John Bolton has been without precedent.
Few executive branch nominees have ever received more scrutiny than Ambassador Bolton.
And Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat, Connecticut, a member of the same committee, saying there's still a problem with John Bolton, with his personality, more importantly, a problem with his work.
My objection isn't that he's a bully, but that he's been an ineffective bully and can't win the day when it comes, when it really counts.
Okay, here we come, David Gergen, back to the issue of leadership and followership. Is John Bolton the right voice in the UN? Is he developing a world where people want to follow the American lead?
Well, you know, people have very divided views about John Bolton, and the Washington Post this week, I think, properly described him as a political rock star among conservatives in the United States because he stood up to the UN, he's exposed its foibles, and while others think he's a bully as a diplomat and think he's further isolated the United States, this is all going to be replayed on the, I think, on the floor of the Senate. Eleanor's closer to what the outcome's likely to be, but the real issue is I think the Republicans would vote to confirm him, and the issue, I suppose, is whether the Democrats can mount a successful filibuster, whether they have that in their hearts to do that. And I don't know the answer to that, but it's going to be a close fight. And it illustrates that there are divisions here at home on American foreign policy, even though at the moment the country has given tacit support to the president on Israel versus Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor Clift, when this came up before, Senator Voinovich of Ohio, Republican, practically in tears in opposition to Bolton, now talking a softer line. How does it look? Is this a shoe-in to have him confirmed?
Yeah, I think he's going to have a relatively easy confirmation. Senator Voinovich was the chief obstacle on the Republican side, and he basically gave cover to a lot of Democrats who were opposing Mr. Bolton. I think now, because we're in the middle of this crisis in the Middle East, and John Bolton is seen as the voice of the administration, the voice of toughness, and if you will, the sort of the siding with Israel, I think in the political context of real American politics, that the Democrats are not going to go to the mat to oppose John Bolton. And you can make the argument that now is not the time really to remove a UN ambassador and bring somebody else in who's new and would have to go through the training and the learning curve at a time when our presence in the U.N. is really critical.
And yet, everybody says the U.S. needs allies now. David Gergen, will this man bring us allies?
Not many. But he does rally the Republican faithful, and we have an election, off-year election around the corner. Where I think the bigger fight is likely to come in the United States is when the dust does settle, when we do have a cessation of hostilities among between the Israelis and Hezbollah, however that ends. I think people are going to turn back to Iraq. And you know, Tom, at the moment, while the headlines were preoccupied with Israel and Hezbollah, it's still true that nearly three times as many people are dying every day in Iraq as are dying in the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. It's still true that Iraq is deteriorating. And now we have a situation where we thought about this time of the year we begin to see headlines about modest reductions in U.S. forces there. We'd have redeployments away from the streets into camps that are safer in Iraq. We have just the opposite going on. We have the United States bolstering its U.S. forces on the streets of Baghdad.
Extending deployments, months and months more.
Mm-hmm. And this situation is such a mess, and in all the talk about Israel and Hezbollah, we've lost sight of the fact. We're losing sight. We need to get back to the fact that Iraq is where we have 130,000 of our own troops, and Iraq has to be resolved in some successful way, and right now it's moving very far south, and the fear is, of course, that the increasing isolation of the United States and Israel on the Hezbollah front is going to make it more complicated in Iraq. It's only going to whip up the anti-Americanism in Iraq itself and leave us less likely to come out with some sort of success there. I mean, it was shocking to me, frankly, that after all this time and effort to build up a new democratic government in Iraq, a government we were promised would be a force for stability, and a government that says, "Stand, you know, here comes Maliki here to our Congress and says, I am with you in the fight against terrorism." And yet on a moment of truth, when Hezbollah is a force for terrorism against Israel, Maliki stands up on the side of the terrorists, on the side of Hezbollah, and doesn't stay with us or doesn't keep his mouth shut. And it seems to me we've spent all this money and spilled all this blood to create a government that's going to be on the side of terrorists like Hezbollah. What in the heck have we accomplished here?
Democracy. If this is democracy and this is the answer, what does that say about the big project?
Yeah. He's an Arab before he is a puppet of the U.S.
And has
government.
Constituencies of his own at home,
right.
Eleanor,
and
David?
Yes, and in fact, the success of the insurgency in Iraq has really emboldened other groups in the Middle East. And I think that we have basically empowered Iran. We got rid of the Taliban for them in Afghanistan. We got rid of their Saddam Hussein, who was an enemy, and Iran has now got a lot of the high cards in that part of the world.
And it is sad to hear this, but
American nightmare.
Yeah, but is Maliki supposed to just say whatever Washington tells him to say now, David?
He's not supposed to say whatever Washington tells him to say. But we were promised, after all, this was an administration that led us into war, saying we're going to create a democracy that will be a force for stability. And if we just create a government that is a handmaiden for terrorism in the Middle East, we have failed in the fundamental mission.
Jean-Michel's calling from Boston. Hi, Jean, you're on the air.
Hello. I've been hearing a lot of saying about George Bush. What happened, the mistrust that has been created all over the world with respect to the United States has been around for ages. For probably 200 years. No one can trust the U.S. anymore. If we look at the wars that the United States has waged, all those wars have not been just.
Well, I don't know about 200 years, and I don't know about all the wars, but David Gergen, I would be happy to have the level of trust from the global community that the United States had just a few short years ago compared to where it stands today. You write about leadership. As a global leader, how are we doing?
Well, we at the moment we certainly don't have many followers, and if you judge leadership by your capacity to mobilize others in the pursuit of shared goals, clearly we are not leading. It may be possible. There may be by some miracle, maybe all of this will turn out well and we'll all live happily ever after, in which case we'll all salute George W. Bush and say we got it wrong. But at the moment, you have to say that the United States has abandoned its role of serving as a coalition leader of much of the world and trying to build international norms and institutions. You know, after all, that much of why we were trusted earlier on, especially after the World War II ended, was we were not only a generous nation, but we were a nation after World War II with Harry Truman, a Democrat, and Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, bipartisan coalition to try to build a set of institutions and laws and norms by which we would all abide. And so we have these series of things where not only we walk away from the UN and walk away from Kyoto and walk away from the International Criminal Court, but we also have, you know, we have people now fundamentally questioning whether the Geneva Convention ought to apply to the United States. So there's a reason why much of the world is looking at this and saying, why have you guys lost your way?
And meanwhile, at home, the Congress looking at much more domestic issues. I mean, it's hard to take your eye off this crisis developing in the Middle East and beyond. But here, at home, here's Congress looking at abortion and interstate travel of minors for abortion, passing the Senate voting this week to make it a crime to take a pregnant minor to another state. Eleanor Clift, what is it about the politics of this that have it coming up now? Is this more preparation for the midterm elections?
Yes, and that's the short answer. Yeah, the Senate voted, I think, 65 votes in favor of banning the taking of a minor across state lines in order to get an abortion.
Even if it's clergy, even if it's her grandparents, still
right.
Banned.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's been characterized by progressives as the grandmother incarceration rule. And by its proponents as an effort to stop sexual predators from taking children across the state lines. And so it's a very divisive issue, and it's an effort basically to cast the Democrats on the side of, you know, favoring abortion. And, you know, it's also it's catering to the social conservatives whose votes the Republicans really need in the fall. I'm not sure how many people this would actually affect, probably a very small number. And so it's more symbolism than anything else.
But it brings out the fireworks. Let's listen to Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer saying that the bill isolates pregnant teens who are scared and seeking help.
The governments can still go after a grandma, a clergyman, who says to a young child, "Let me help you. Your father raped you under this bill."
There's punching the emotion button. Let's listen to Republican Senator Jim DeMint saying any teenager considering abortion needs the support of their informed parents.
Much worse than hearing of a pregnancy would be the news that a daughter was suffering from infertility or any of the other severe medical and emotional complications often associated with abortion.
So there we are, abortion at home while the fires rage abroad. David Gergen, what about leadership on the domestic front? How do you see it at home in terms of pulling Americans together?
Well, it's hard to be overly encouraged, isn't it? I think Eleanor's right. There is an effort here that's being made, and if the Democrats were in power, you'd see the same thing by them. You know, when a party
same
is in
thing
trouble,
in terms of
I think it would be looking to play on the emotional heartstrings or on the emotions of its own base in order to build up a dispirited electorate. What you have mm-hmm. here is a really important survey done for NPR that was just released mm-hmm. this week, looking at 50 congressional districts. Stan Greenberg and a couple other people put this together, and what it found was that as with the midterm elections a few weeks away now, that in these 50 key districts, 40 of which were Republican, 10 Democratic, they're the swing districts, that the Democrats are modestly ahead, but the intensity level for intention of voting is on the Democratic side. In other words, Democrats are more upset by what they see than Republicans are positive about what they see going on here and overseas. And so what the Republicans need to do is stir up the intensity of their voters, their conservative base. And when you pass a bill or get a bill on the floor like this abortion bill, it's a way to tell the base there are important issues at stake in this election that go beyond Iraq, that go beyond gas prices, and come out and vote for us because these other people are, you know, they're villains or they're going to lead the country astray or they're going to destroy the moral fabric of the country. That's what's really going on here.
Time to mix it up. Joseph's calling from Deerfield, New Hampshire. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be very brief.
Yeah.
Seems to me like the reason that this war is still going on is just the three main puppet masters being ourselves, Iran and the Saudis. And it just seems to me like there's a lot of money being made, a tremendous amount, in the turmoil and strife with the oil market. And basically, Bush is going to let this go on for as long as he possibly can to raise the prices. Same with Iran. We all know that the turmoil creates money, and we're seeing it every day. And I really don't see that, you know, this is going to change at all in the next 2 weeks.
Boy, there's deep suspicion. I mean, puppet strings go in lots of directions here, but those oil profit numbers are very big, kind of eye-popping, many tens of billions in the last quarter for the big American oil companies. Eleanor Clift, how's the Congress, Washington, responding to that? More pressure to put some cap on those or not?
No. Actually, they're looking to rush through legislation to open up more drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. But I must say, I was struck by a front-page story of the New York Times today about all of the reconstruction projects that involve major U.S. corporations and all of the cost overruns and
reconstruction
what a mess they have been
Iraq?
in Iraq. And the fact that that they're dropping Bechtel, a huge construction company, from a project to build a children's hospital that Laura Bush had praised because it exceeded the cost by as much as 150%. And so I imagine that's going to be something that we will look into in more detail once the violence is behind us. But what a disaster the corporate reconstruction effort has been in Iraq.
And the billions still going. David Gergen, our time is short. Look at this presidency. We have, 2 years left. This is typically a tough stretch for a president, especially 6 years down already. The lame duck thing comes up. At this moment, I mean, how do you grade this president, this presidency? Do we have someone setting out the bold new vision for a new century, or do we have the makings of disaster here?
Well, let me come back to the oil question. First, on this one, let me defend the administration. I don't think that for a second George W. Bush is prolonging this in order to keep oil prices up and put money in the pockets of oil companies. This is all about geopolitics and what he conceives of as a war on terrorism. I really don't think it's fair to blame the president on the other side and to see all sorts of conspiracy theories here. But beyond that, the best we can say right now is that George W. Bush deserves an incomplete. There is a growing possibility that unless he can turn this around, he's going to go down in history as not only a flawed but a deeply failed president. And it's much is now going to revolve around whether he can pull this out in Iraq and whether he can bring some sort of lasting peace to the Middle East. And those prospects are very problematic now. It's pretty obvious. But the other thing is, this is a time when neither this president nor the Congress, and Democrats share the blame, have looked ahead to the long-term interests of the country, whether it's and they have not acted before storms hit, whether it's on the environment or energy or health care, on education in schools, facing the rising competition from China and India. You know, historical judgments are often based on about leadership are often based on how well did you anticipate the future.
Mm-hmm. That's the job.
That's the job, and to address the issues that are coming at us. And in our preoccupation with Iraq, frankly, we have taken our eye off these other concerns that are going to have an enormous impact on the well-being of American citizens. Our grandchildren are going to grow up in a pretty difficult world unless we act swiftly. And we don't see signs of our political leadership in Washington today facing up to what the future for our grandkids is going to be like.
Not a super heartening week, but we're grateful to both of you for helping us look at it. Eleanor Clift, contributing editor for Newsweek in Washington. Eleanor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And David Gergen at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of Eyewitness to Power. David, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. It's a privilege.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.